Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to the HIV Podcast. Each week, we focus on a person, historical event, or pop culture moment linked to HIV and explore the story of what actually happened. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Jess. And between us, we've been working in the field of HIV for 40 years. Our aim is to get as many people as possible HIV educated.
Welcome to the HIV Podcast.
This week's guest is the best public speaker and a dream to watch. Going around the country, educating young people in school about HIV. That is what she is known for. And she does it absolutely brilliantly. But we're not here to focus on that today, mainly because we did an episode on her last year. Today, we're focusing on the reality of being a long-term survivor of HIV. So welcome, Emma Cole.
Yay!
Definitely need some sort of cheering noise, don't we?
Oh, I might try and find a sound effect. So, Emma, yes. Just to fill you in, whenever we've tried to do an applause, our microphones are so good that they think it's some sort of interference and it just gets silenced. So, yeah, I need to find a sound effect. So maybe I'll work on that this week.
How are you, Emma?
I'm really good, thank you. Just had a couple of days travelling up north, up on the Wirral on Tuesday for a couple of schools. So that was a bit of a long drive, but thankfully Boris, my fiancé, did all the driving. So that makes life so much easier.
Oh, like your own personal chauffeur. I love it. Excellent. Zoe, who is in the background of the podcast, well, actually she did an episode with me a few weeks ago, is from that neck of the woods. We try not to refer to it at the moment because she is an avid Liverpool football supporter. And yeah.
Well, they might turn it around tonight. You never know.
You're a football fan, aren't you, Emma? Oh, she's got a QPR mug out. She's showing us the QPR mug.
Lovely.
Yeah, let's not talk too much about football right now.
You know that awkward pause when you're like, oh, QPR, yeah, they're okay.
Sucking into the relegation zone as I speak.
Let's move on to, just move on.
Give me a topic.
So, yes, long-term survivor of HIV. How long have you been diagnosed?
This year it will be 33 years. So September the 11th, 1991 was my diagnosis.
Yeah. I mean, that is a long time. Come on.
Yes. Yeah. More than half my life now. I can't actually remember life without HIV, which is a bit weird. But yeah.
That must be odd to have that where you think actually now this is just, you know, my whole life that
well,
I can remember.
Because in reality, it was the majority of my adult life I've been positive. I was diagnosed when I was 22. So I'd just finished uni. I hadn't really sort of grown up, if you like. I hadn't sort of gone off into the world and done anything. I was just literally finishing uni when I found out. So my entire, what I call adult life, I've been positive. And obviously back then we weren't expected to live. You know, the stark reality in the early 90s, late 80s was prepared to die because there was no treatments. There was no you equals you. There was no hope or expectation of a life. So, you know, those early, certainly the early decade for me was quite difficult, facing what I thought was going to be an imminent death.
And do you feel a sense of achievement now that you've proved them wrong? Because here you are.
Not so much achievement. I'm just incredibly grateful. I always said if I reached the 10th anniversary, every day after that, I would see it as a bonus. And that's very much sort of how I've lived the last two decades. But there's always that fear of the unknown, because, you know, I haven't got role models who've lived 40, 50 years with HIV. You know, those being diagnosed more recently can look at people like me and fellow long-term survivors and go, oh, wow, someone who's lived 33 years, amazing, that could be me. Whereas I don't have that person to look up to. You know, in the last year, 6 long-term survivors I know have died. So for us, the reality is we're still seeing death and dying amongst people with HIV, whereas someone more recently diagnosed is probably never going to have an AIDS-related death in their life. And, you know, I don't think you can underestimate the impact those constant grieving we had to go through in the early years has had on us. But people don't want to talk about it. You know, you don't want a newly diagnosed person doesn't want to hear about the death and the dying and the trauma we went through. And yet those of us who are still here live with it daily.
It needs to be said.
It does, because, you know, we're sort of invisible in the HIV world. There's so much services for newly diagnosed. There's so much sort of stuff to sort of get people back, you know, into work and stuff. But it's kind of like, apart from one online group I found, you know, there's very little for long-term survivors. And yet we do still have issues we have to deal with that are very specific to us who were diagnosed in those early years.
Absolutely. Right. Agree with you on that. Definitely. I think you are a hidden group within society, and there is a lot of focus on newly diagnosed and how we support them. But I also feel there's huge value in listening to those who've lived with HIV for a long time. Their lived experience is so important, but I don't think we capture that as well as we perhaps could.
I mean, there's even a long-term survivors day, isn't there? And we only had learnt about that last year.
Well, it's very much an American thing. It's not really adopted over here. I mean, I think it started in America and it tends to be very much focused on America. But obviously with social media, people like myself usually do something on that day just to acknowledge it. But it's not a recognised day here in the UK.
Yeah, we've been trying to highlight that more. Someone actually got in touch with us last year, didn't they, Sarah, to say, please, can you help? You know, I'm a long-term survivor. Please, can you help highlight this day? So we do try to do that each year. So, yeah.
I mean, again, that's the beauty of social media. I mean, I did an interview once for the World Service, and there were a couple of people who'd been diagnosed, and they said, oh, yeah, I put it on YouTube. And I went on Twitter and I went, well, when I was diagnosed, the internet didn't exist. And they looked at me like I was a dinosaur. It's like, what? You know, there was no internet at some point. It's like, yes, you know, we couldn't Google a support group. We couldn't, you know, sort of go online and meet peer mentors or any of that. It was just, there was nothing. You know, you physically had to go to a support group. And, you know, they were few and far between in those early years.
So let's use this platform then, because I think there's a lot of focus at the moment on zero transmissions by 2030, rightly so. But as a long-term survivor, what issues should the sector be focusing on?
There are issues such as, you know, those of us, like I was 22 when I was diagnosed. So there's probably a cohort of people similar age to me, early 50s now, mid 50s, but have been living with HIV for 30 odd years. You know, we couldn't get mortgages, so most of us don't own properties. We couldn't get life insurance. You know, I couldn't pay into my work pension when I started working because they said you're not going to be alive to need it. A lot of us are facing financial issues as we age, because all the things that you might have put in place thinking you were going to live didn't happen for us. So I know there are an awful lot of people who struggle financially now as they're aging with HIV, because all the things you would have had in place had you not had HIV aren't there. You know, I haven't got a property I can sell and sort of downsize to something and have a nest egg. So I think that's one of the issues. I do think things like just the mental stress that is there constantly. I mean, everyone with HIV, I think, experiences it. But if you've had it more than half your life, just that constant sort of strain on your body. And it's not just the mental strain. Obviously, we know that inflammation is ongoing in people with HIV, even with treatment. And for those of us long-term survivors, we didn't get put straight on meds. We had to wait till our CD4 count dropped below 200 before we were offered meds. So for a lot of us, we've had a decade of untreated HIV. We don't know the long-term implications of that. So there's a whole range of stuff. And, you know, if I was in charge of research, I'd be saying, get these people who are still alive and study them to the nth degree, because there's obviously something we're doing that is keeping us alive. And, you know, I think it would be valuable to know a bit more about why some of us are still here and others aren't.
It's not, there just isn't enough research happening, is there? You're absolutely right.
Well, there is research on certain aspects, but certainly not looking at us as long-term survivors. There's one study, the Poppy study, that has done that, and that's ongoing. But, you know, new trials for new drugs, for instance, probably will exclude anyone who's a long-term survivor, because they usually want treatment-naive people. So again, you know, some of the newer drugs that come along, I'm thinking, well, I don't want to be on anything that I know has not been tested on someone like me.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, for like last year, I actually asked my doctor to put me back on monotherapy, because I just knew the newer drugs hadn't been agreeing with me. And, you know, again, it's like we know our bodies so intimately after all these years with HIV that, you know, I'm very fortunate. I'm very assertive. So I can say to my doctor, not going to take this newer drug anymore. Don't like it. Put me back on my PI. Mm. But, you know, for some patients, they may not have that ability, or, you know, for a lot of people, you know, doctors are gods and you do what they say. But, you know, I know I've learned over the years that to get anywhere with HIV, I have to be assertive and I have to sort of own my space and go, this is what I need. This is what I want.
I think that's really great for,
I'm just
for
really
people
stroppy.
To hear.
Oops.
That's perfect. Stroppiness is perfect. But I think that's really good for people to hear, because I'm certainly one of those people who, you know, my doctor will say something and I think, oh, I should definitely do that. And actually, it might not be right for me, but I'll still forge forward. So I think it's really useful for everyone to hear. Actually, sometimes you should listen to yourself and be slightly pushy. Be a bit stroppy.
Talking about how kind of growing older with HIV, men and women age differently. One of the things we found on this podcast is that there is very little information about how HIV affects you growing older. Have you found that kind of within the context of HIV, consideration has been given to the fact that men and women fundamentally are different, age in different ways, and you can't have a one treatment or one kind of support for all?
Well, yes, obviously, you know, the obvious thing for women as the age is the menopause. Mm. I mean, again, you know, I was diagnosed at 22, expected to only live 10 years. So I thought, fantastic, no need to worry about the menopause in the future. That's not going to be my problem. Oh, hello. You know, yeah, obviously, that's one big factor that affects women differently. Again, I still worry about some of the drugs have been probably trialed more in men than women. So again, it's that, do we really know how the female body is reacting to some of these newer drugs? And often, you know, if the studies are done, say, on the African continent, again, you can look at it and go, well, you know, is there going to be a racial difference in how people respond to treatment? And I just don't think the research sort of has set up to study, you know, everyone.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've always said I felt invisible as a newly diagnosed woman, and I feel invisible as an older white woman with HIV. It just don't exist as far as services are concerned.
Again, I think that's a really important point to make. I think it's really important that we're highlighting this around long-term survivors and the invisibility of being an older woman, an older white woman. It's, yeah, it's a hidden group, isn't it?
Yes, and not, you know, and you are seeing sort of my demographic being diagnosed late as well, sort of heterosexual women. You know, I picked up the safer sex message at university. That was like the late 80s. But, you know, in recent years, you don't see a safer sex message targeted at people like me, sort of middle-aged, you know, the WI going ladies or anything like that. So, you know, I think the messaging for safer sex and you equals you and all of that hasn't really reached my demographic. And again, you know, I could go, you know, go into the local supermarket and stop, you know, 10 people and go, do you know what you equals you means? And no one would have a clue. Even in my immediate peer group, I don't, you know, of friends who are not HIV positive, I don't think that message is known. You know, I often wonder who's coming up with these campaigns, because they still only seem to target what is considered the most at-risk groups. Then others get completely sort of missed. And then so when people are diagnosed from that different demographic, then obviously it's way more shocking for them because they've thought, well, I've didn't think it could ever happen to me.
And often they're not armed with the information of knowing, okay, actually, I'm not going to die. You know, you equals you. If I take my meds, I'm not going to pass it on. So like you're saying, if you don't have that knowledge and you're diagnosed, that is a big shock. But I mean, Sarah and I talk frequently, don't we, Sarah, about all of the different campaigns there are. I feel like a lot of them, we've said this quite a lot of the campaigns feel like you should already have like a baseline level of knowledge around HIV. And that's, we just can't rely on that.
No, absolutely not. Because you know, say if you're, say, a middle-aged person now, your knowledge would have come from the 80s or the 90s, where, you know, it was still very much gay and bisexual men injecting drug users. So people would have just gone, see, it's not my problem. And, you know, from, you know, just this week, I sort of said in one of the talks, you know, if you've ever had unprotected sex, you should consider an HIV test, because then going forward, you can make informed choices. And I actually had one of the students DM me on Instagram later saying, because of what you said, I'm going to get tested. And I just thought, wow, see that. And she said, I would never have thought of it if I'd not heard your talk, you know. And, you know, you see sort of young people heading off to uni soon in sort of, you know, in September, and, you know, have a lot more freedom probably than perhaps they had when they were around home. It's safe. I got infected from one incident, so I know it can happen. And I just think, you know, people need to be much more aware that, yes, we have got huge numbers of people with HIV on treatment and undetectable, but there's still that cohort of people who don't know they're positive. And, yeah, you know, it just takes one time for some people.
So true, isn't it? I do think we've got mixed messaging being put out there. I know, and we've talked about this before, haven't we, Jess, on our podcast? The frustration we feel when the messages from above, as in government, I'm talking about God, but when the messages come down or filter down as to who we should be targeting, and here's a tiny pot of money to do it, and it doesn't correlate with the people that we see walking through the door, newly diagnosed, into our drop-in centre.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's just also those sort of rites of passage things, like, you know, you reach 18, you go on holiday with your mate. How many people have a one night stand on a sort of summer holiday and never think anything more of it? And then 10, 15 years down the line, it could come back to bite you. You know, it's those sorts of things that people don't sort of think about. And, you know, I was sort of just thinking, yes, I know so many teenagers who, you know, 18, 19, go off on that sort of lads holiday or girls break and whatever. And you just think, do young people go out then with the knowledge, oh, I must take protection with me, or I must take precautions? I don't think they do.
No, I would say absolutely not.
That air of invincibility when you're young. And, you know, as I say, one incident could have consequences for the rest of your life.
I think, I mean, I've got two teenage sons, and obviously I know other parents with teenage sons, and I guarantee that they are not having conversations with their children about safe sex. It's, as a parent, I just don't think still in this day and age, we feel equipped to have those conversations. I do, to the point where I think I've probably pushed it too far, Emma.
You also have to realise that
most young people's sex education, if you like, comes from watching porn these days. So it's not as if, you know, and do you see them making a huge sort of effort on in porn to show condoms? No, we're letting down a whole generation, really.
Porn is where people are getting the majority of their sex education from, and porn, for the most part, we're not seeing condoms in it, we're seeing bareback sex, and they're the messages we're putting out there. And I think that's amazing that your talks are reaching people to say, right, actually, you've prompted me to test, because it seems to be the thing that we feel that positive people, the onus is on them to know their status, but actually we should all know our HIV status. That's the message to be drilling in, isn't it?
Yeah, and that has been sort of the message that's been sort of, you know, pushed forward by things like THT in recent years, sort of know your status. And it is important. But again, you know, if you've stopped, you know, 100 people in the street and said, would you take an HIV test today? Let's say probably 99% would say, why? It's not my problem. You know, and that's, I think, the thing we've still got to overcome is that, you know, people don't see HIV as their problem.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We actually had a comment on our social media recently that said, why? I haven't heard about HIV in 20 years. What's this all about? It's exactly that attitude, isn't it? That, oh, why? Has something happened? Like, no.
We're still having, what, 2,500 new cases diagnosed each year in the UK in recent years? I've always said in the last 20 years, no one should have got HIV in this country. If the safer sex message had worked and everybody understood that if they were having unprotected sex, they could put themselves at risk, we'd have no sexually transmitted HIV cases. Mm. And yet the numbers are there for all to see.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I say, vast majority of the people would say, well, I didn't think HIV was something I needed to be worried about.
You're absolutely right.
I've been speaking about it from day one. I remember, you know, I went on the old Kilroy show within 6 weeks of being diagnosed.
Going on national television. That's why I love you, Emma. You never do things by halves, do you?
No, I just threw myself straight into it. I always say I used to think the more I talked about it, it might go away. Rollers, no, it's here to stay.
I want to come back to the thing you mentioned earlier about pensions, because I think that's a really, really valid point, because people were told in the 80s and 90s to cash in your pensions.
Say, I hadn't even started. I'd started work just as I graduated. I had 6 months after diagnosis where I was on unemployment benefit. Realised that that was absolutely not going to get me anywhere in life. So I said, right, you know, regardless of HIV, I've got to get a job to pay rent and blah, blah, blah. And I remember the first job I was offered, it was a 3-month contract. And I thought, well, I might just live long enough to see it out. Because I had this sort of like, I'm sure I'm going to die sooner than they told me. But when I sort of signed all the paperwork to take the job and I said, what about a pension? I said, you know, I am HIV positive. They said, oh, no. There's no point bothering paying into a pension if you're not going to live to need one. And, you know, I ended up working there for 10 years. And I do regret now not challenging that in the early days because, you know, I say I would have had a workplace pension in place if I'd, you know, known things were going to be different. So many of us don't have pensions.
Yeah.
We couldn't get a property. You know, if I'd known I was going to survive, I'd have bought a place 33 years ago and had at least had a sort of, you know, a nest egg to fall back on. But, you know, the one good thing that I have done all my life ever since I was a teenager is saved money. You know, I had 2 Saturday jobs and, you know, I always put money aside. So it was funny in one way when COVID hit and I lost a vast majority of my school's work stopped and I didn't have to worry about money because I'd saved up thinking HIV would stop me working. And in fact, it was another virus that came along. But the HIV money had been put aside, you know, just so that I knew I always had something to fall back on, you know, but things like sort of old, you know, going into care as you age, you know. That's a big fear for a lot of people because obviously the care sector probably hasn't had up-to-date knowledge about HIV. I know things are changing for some people. They're trying to get that happening. It's like, well, if I'm not in control of taking my meds and I've got to rely on someone else to give me them, you know, that would be a worry for some people. And obviously there's still the stigma. We talk about it all the time. If you're going to be in a care facility with other people, and your HIV status becomes known, that could be hugely problematic for someone. I know it's rather grim, but I keep thinking, oh, I still hope I die before I need that, you know, because I don't want that, you know. You know, I remember the early years where nurses went in, out and put spacesuits on to take my blood. You know, I've had all that. I don't want to go through that as I age with people freaking out and thinking, I need to put a spacesuit on to treat this woman. Yes. You know, because I've been there, done it, got the T-shirt and carry the traumas. So.
Yeah. I think, again, it's a very valid point. And one that we've talked about as a team is as the first generation people living with HIV grow older and may well move into care homes, how are they going to access sexual health clinics?
Yeah.
Because that doesn't happen at the moment. I don't think there's a care home in the country that's driving their residents to the sexual health clinic so that they can have their annual or biannual bloods done.
You're so right. That's such a good point. And obviously, as we know, the sexual health clinic isn't linked to your GP and your sort of wider NHS records. So if someone, say if you're in a care home and someone is sort of getting your prescription sent to you, then how is that going to be arranged in terms of through a sexual health clinic as well? Sorry, you can watch my internal cogs going round as I'm like, my mind is being blown slightly. How will it be managed?
And also some patients still haven't told their GPs they're positive. Mm-hmm. So you might have a GP prescribing stuff for someone in care, you know, which has, and they have no idea of the HIV drugs they might be taking and all that, contraindications and oh gosh.
Yeah.
It's a worry, but as I say, being slightly morbid, I kind of hope I go before I need to worry about that. You know, I do still have the coffin in my living room. I did get prepared many years ago, so...
You're just such an organised person, aren't you?
Not organised, control freak. I went to too many funerals realising, and obviously when Ian, my partner, died, I had to help arrange the funeral and I was just so shocked by the costs. I thought, right, I'm going to just get organised in advance, and I just went ahead and bought it, and it's in the living room as a window box at the moment. It's a window seat.
I was going to ask, is it your coffee table?
But no, it's a storage box. I've just got my old vinyl record collection is inside because I don't have a record deck at the moment. And I've just got loads of books and stuff piled on the top.
In my mind, I had visions of you and your partner Boris pranking each other, someone just leaping out from it to scare them. Can you imagine?
No, it's too full at the moment. Although I did get in it once, because I'm so tight with money. When I bought it, it was flat packed. So I actually had to build my own coffin. So when I finished it, I did actually get in to check it. I fitted okay.
That's kind of amazing. You have built your own coffin.
I know. Not many people can say that, can they?
I'd say barely anyone. That's amazing.
It's very prepared. I remember long-term service users at TVBS reminiscing about years ago where they and I think you need this dark sense of humor actually to get through life living with HIV. Exactly. They had cardboard coffins that they all decorated, and it's a great kind of art therapy thing.
Oh yeah, mine's all painted.
Is it?
A lot of this artwork behind is all mine, so I've painted my coffin. It's all bright colors and everything. Yeah.
We should get on this.
African cultures where decorating the coffins are really a big thing. And I saw a TV documentary about it and I just thought, well, why can't I paint mine then? So I just got the brushes out and started painting.
That's fabulous.
Again, thinking of long-term survivors, you know, there are people who couldn't bury their partners how they wanted, because in those early years, many funeral undertakers wouldn't care for people with HIV who died, or they had to have lead coffins because people were afraid of catching something, you know. And you just think, you know, there are people who still have those memories and who still have those, you know, didn't get the funeral they wanted because of the traumas in the early years. And again, it's things like that that no one has to think about today, but you know, we did.
No, you're right, they don't have to today. Have you ever thought of kind of recording your kind of memoirs or illustrating your memoirs?
Well, I've done, obviously, I did the Positive Women documentary for the BBC back in 2001, and recorded my story for the British Sound Archive that was used on AIDS The Unheard Tape, the BBC documentary last year, I think it was. So, I mean, I do want to write my book, but I remember taking it to a publisher about, I think it was when I reached the 20th anniversary, and they basically said, oh, no, nobody would want to read something like that. Too depressing. And so I kind of got a bit disheartened. But, you know, the book is all ready to sort of go. I've got all my sort of chapter outlines and stuff. But I'm not a confident writer. So I'd probably have to get a ghostwriter to sort of work with me. But the book is ready to go if I actually kind of commit to doing it. But I kept journals for the first 20 odd years of my life with HIV. So I've got an awful lot of material from those early years. And, you know, again, for me, it's like there will be a time in the not too distant future where all of us from those early years are gone. And, you know, it would be terribly sad if people's in the future, their only knowledge of HIV comes from those more recently diagnosed who didn't experience it at its worst.
I think you're right.
And of course, sorry, I just also remembered I did record my story for the National HIV Story Trust. I think that's what they call it.
Yes.
So there is a video recording that's sort of in an archive somewhere. So that will always be available. So I've done bits and pieces. But again, you know, if you've only got an hour, you can't say everything. And often you sort of, you know, finish recording and then go, oh, I never told them I set up Body and Soul, or I never told them I set up Living Well. And, you know, all the things that I've achieved in my life with HIV that I just think, oh, yeah, I did that. But actually, most people don't know I did it.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's nice to hear you say that, you know, you're proud of what you've achieved, because you have achieved so much.
Yeah, well, as I say, I mean, for me, what I'm most proud is the education work, you know, and, you know, I'm meeting teachers who heard me when they were pupils and they still remember the talk. And I met a lovely teacher recently who'd heard me when he was a pupil, so 15, 20 years ago. And he said after uni, he went off traveling with a friend. And his friend, the next after a night out, kind of confided in him. He thought he needed to take an HIV test. And this teacher said, because I'd heard your talk, I knew everything that I needed to say. And I went with him and supported him because I'd learned from you not to be afraid of HIV. And you just think those little things are what keep me going, because I never know who's listening, you know, who might be affected by HIV in an audience. And, you know, and I have had students come up and confide that they lost a family member in the past to AIDS related deaths. And I'm the first person they've shared that with. And you think, wow, if they've carried that around for so long, not feeling they could tell a friend or a teacher that they lost a grandparent to AIDS or whatever, you know, that's terribly sad. And, you know, I just feel like if I can just do that for one or two people a year, then, you know, it's worth me carrying on.
We should say as well, your talks, I mean, Sarah and I were lucky enough, you invited us to come along. It was sort of, you were in our area and you were so funny. And I feel a bit like people probably wouldn't expect that. Do you know what I mean? From talking about, right, I'm a long-term survivor of HIV, but you just had these young people, because, and I didn't expect it to be as funny as it was. It was brilliant. Like, I almost want you to take it, we said, to the Edinburgh Fringe, because I want to be able to sell this podcast. If you can get it to go and see Emma, go and see her.
Funny enough, I've had several teachers and students say, oh, you could do a stand-up show based on your life story. And maybe that's a sort of on the to-do list before I die sort of thing. But funny enough, I'm going back to that school you came to next week.
I've never seen a room full of teenagers so quiet.
Well, that's the funny thing is, of course, because I don't say off straight away what I'm going to, you know, my story. So, you know, you have all the laughs in the first 15, 20 minutes. And then as soon as I disclose my result was positive, the room goes silent, and, you know, and then we build up again and have more jokes later on. But yes, it's it is quite an impactful talk, even if I say that myself.
I mean, it kept mine and Jess's attention. I mean, you just the way you draw people in, it's so clever. And that's,
you know,
why
not just from years of experience of delivering. I mean, you know, obviously when I first started delivering the talks, it was very different. I was preparing to die. I was losing friends every month, you know, funeral after funeral. And, you know, it's quite nice sometimes to see that some of the teachers who've known me for 15, 20 years and go, wow, it's so interesting to watch your journey and your transition to this new stage of life with HIV, because, you know, we never expected you to still be here from those early years. Yeah. But, you know, yeah, and I think I'm up to over 2,000 talks I've delivered now. So it's pretty impressive. You know, I don't think anyone coming down the line will ever catch up with me, because obviously, you know, from those early years, there's no one else around still talking publicly as far as I know. So.
And it's so important. It's so important to get into schools and to give these messages. And I mean, the fact that you make it funny, I talk about that because that's sort of what we try to do. I feel like you hold people more, they remember it more. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I could very easily give a very dark and depressing version of the last 33 years with HIV, but then I wouldn't keep an audience. And the whole thing about if you're speaking publicly is you've got to maintain that sort of contact with your audience. They have to be engaged. And, you know, and I like to think I take anyone who listens on the roller coaster that my life has been. You know, there are highs, there are lows, there are funny bits, there are sad bits, you know, it's all there, you know. And yes, someone could say, well, you have that without HIV in your life, but, you know, I've managed to, as I say, bring it all together in a way that engages young people. And as I say, and it does, you know, I've had students after my talk go on to write A-level drama plays about me. They've done their EPQs, their extended projects on HIV as a result of what they've heard. Some students have gone off to uni and then come back and said, oh, I'm doing a project for my uni degree on HIV. Can I interview you? So you just, you know, and I'm always giving, you know, for me, it's like I'm still here. And while I'm here, I give what I can to anyone who needs it. You know, I don't do things like peer mentoring or anything like that, because, again, I did it all in the early years. You know, I was on the body positive helpline for the first 6 years after diagnosis, helping other people with HIV deal with anything. You know, I set up charities, and I did it all. I don't need to be doing that again now. But if someone reaches out to me on Instagram or Twitter or whatever, I will put either, you know, direct them to the services that can provide support, or give them some one-to-one if they need it. You know, I think I'm doing quite a fair bit for everyone, even if it's sort of a bit more remote than being in a service delivering face-to-face.
Gosh, I think you're doing more than enough. There's just been so much, hasn't there? Oh, my goodness. Okay, final question.
Okay.
Before we stop recording and have a secret conversation about how we set up a care home specifically for people with HIV, because that's the answer here.
Yeah. Well, funny enough, I do know someone who would be very good at that. And I should have had that conversation with him by now.
Excellent. So it could happen. That would be amazing, wouldn't it? So final question, because we talked earlier about newly diagnosed people. They are not going on the same journey that you went on because of the medication. What would you say to them? Because I think a lot of them will look to you as an inspiration for how they manage this. What's your advice for them?
Take it one day at a time. In the early years or early weeks, months, take it one day at a time. I remember the thing that used to bug me was I used to find in those early weeks that every waking moment was HIV. And I remember the first time I got to a lunchtime and I hadn't thought about it, I was so hugely relieved, thinking, oh, it's not going to be overwhelming after all. And then you might go a day without thinking about it. Now, obviously, slightly different today, because most people go straight on meds, so they've got that daily reminder. But I think for me, it's about taking things very slowly to start with. Yes, I would say peer support in the early weeks, months is very valuable, but also recognize that you probably have an inner strength you don't realize you've got. And I certainly know for me, ultimately, it's me who's got me here, no one else. So sort of have faith in your own ability to cope with a diagnosis. And I think one thing that is different today is there really is no need to disclose, really. You know, I went public very soon afterwards because I thought I was going to get sick and die. I wanted people to be aware and know what was coming. But today there is an argument for saying, actually, no one needs to know. If I take my meds and I get undetectable, I'm at no risk to anyone in terms of sexually passing on the virus. And I can see an argument for saying, actually, there is no reason to be so public these days about it. But then on the flip side, you want people to see us so that if you are newly diagnosed, you can go, oh, I'm not the only one. You know, because I think that was my biggest fear in the early years was I'm the only young white woman with HIV. And it was only when I found others that I realized, actually, I'm not alone. And I think that's the biggest thing, is knowing you're not alone. And even if you only connect remotely, it's knowing you're not the only one going through this, I think, that makes a huge difference.
Yeah, brilliant. Oh, thank you, Emma. We love you so much.
This has been amazing. Yeah, this has been so good. Thank you for giving your time. As you said, you've done tons of things and you already give an awful lot of time. So thank you for finding a little bit more time for us, Emma.
You're welcome. And just in case anyone asks, the picture in the background is when I ran the London Marathon. I said if I reached year 26 of life with HIV, I would run the 26.3 miles.
And how was it? How did you do?
I Boris said to me at the start line, he said, realistically, Em, you haven't really done much training, so how long is it going to take? And I said, I'll do it in 6 hours. And I crossed the finish in 5 hours 56.
Amazing.
So again, you know, for me, and I say it to kids when I'm talking to them, it's like, don't underestimate what you're capable of. If you tell yourself, I can do this, anything is possible. And I look at my marathon thing every day and I still can't believe I did it, but I did. So
perfect.
I can add marathon runner to my list of achievements.
Yes. Thanks for listening to the HIV podcast. If you enjoyed our podcast, please like, rate and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
You can now also follow us on Instagram and TikTok at the HIV Podcast for behind the scenes insights and video. The HIV Podcast is produced by Thames Valley Positive Support.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.